Welcome to True Enough. We are your hosts. I am Catherine Duvall.
And I am Brandon McCowan.
True Enough is a podcast about true crime, both solved and unsolved. It's about notorious crimes. It's also about mysteries and the paranormal.
This week's podcast is about the disappearance of Maura Murray. Maura Murray was just 21 years old when she disappeared on the evening of February 9th, 2004, after her car crashed on Route 112 in Haverhill, New Hampshire. Her whereabouts still remain unknown to this day. Murray was involved in a one-car accident on Route 112 in the Woodsville section of Haverhill in northern New Hampshire between 7 and 7:30 p.m. on February 9th, 2004. Her car, a black 1996 Saturn with Massachusetts license plates, failed to negotiate a sharp curve and ran off the road, striking a tree. Haverhill is 5 miles away from Wells River, Vermont, 1 mile away from Swiftwater Village by the Connecticut River. This was the second car accident Murray had inside of 3 days. She had previously damaged her father's vehicle in another accident. A resident near the site of the February 9th crash called the police, even though Murray had asked him not to. She vanished by the time the authorities arrived at the scene about 10 minutes later. Her car was left behind, severely damaged in the front end. Both airbags had deployed. It was not in drivable condition. The doors were locked, and a few personal belongings, including Murray's cellular phone and credit and bank cards, were missing, but most of her possessions had been left inside. Murray has never been seen again. There were no footprints in the snow around the car, and no indication of a struggle, and tracker dogs lost her scent within 100 yards of the accident site. Police believe she may have gotten a ride from the scene of the accident to parts unknown. The witness to the accident says she did not appear to be injured, but she may have been intoxicated. Murray resided in Hanson, Massachusetts, and was a student at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst at the time she disappeared. The university police were assisting with the case. She was a nursing major and a Dean's List student and was employed by a local art gallery in addition to having a job on campus. She planned to take a nursing job in Oklahoma after graduation. 4 days before she disappeared, she left her job early at her supervisor's suggestion. She appeared to be extremely upset about something and was unable to work. Could this have caused Murray to be so upset that she had to take a break from school? Murray emailed her professors the day of her disappearance and said there was a death in her family and she had to go away, but would be in touch upon her return in about a week. No one had actually died. After her disappearance, Murray's dormitory room was found packed up. She withdrew $280 from her bank account the day she disappeared, but there had been no activity on her bank accounts or credit cards since then. In her packed belongings in her dormitory, she left behind a personal note for her fiancé, an Army lieutenant named William Rausch, who was stationed at Fort Still, Oklahoma. Murray also emailed Rausch on the afternoon of her disappearance. In the email, she asked to speak with him. Investigators inspected Murray's computer after she vanished. They discovered she had been searching on the internet for information about hotels in the Burlington, Vermont area. Based on this information, they checked Burlington hotels for any signs of Murray, but turned up no clues as to her whereabouts. Murray and her father went hiking together in the Burlington area in the fall of 2003, but she has no other connections to the city. She used to camp regularly in New Hampshire and knew the state well, but there are no reasons why she would go to Haverhill. Extensive searches of the woods around Haverhill have turned up no evidence as to her whereabouts. There is speculation that Murray's case may be related to the disappearance of Brianna Maitland, a girl who vanished from Montgomery, Vermont on March 19, 2004. She is also still missing. Montgomery is only about 90 miles from Haverhill. Both of them are attractive brunette young women and both disappeared after car accidents in which their cars were left behind with personal items inside. The FBI met with local authorities to discuss possible links between the cases. However, they concluded that despite apparent similarities, the two females' cases were probably not connected to each other. The theory is not being entirely ruled out, but investigators believe it is an unlikely one. Murray was a student for 2 years at the United States Military Academy at West Point, where she met Rausch before she transferred to the University of Massachusetts. Murray's family says it's uncharacteristic of her not to contact them, and they fear she's being held against her will. She had not been having problems with her family at the time of her disappearance, and she has no history of mental illness. Julie Murray, Maura's sister, told Western Mass News before the accident, her records show she called a condominium owner in Bartlett, New Hampshire, a place her family vacationed. Quote, Maura was familiar with the complex, the sister said, but Maura never made it there. Her sister said this wasn't typical behavior from Maura. School was a top priority, and her car, the 1996 Saturn, was so beat up she rarely drove it. At 3:15, the day of her disappearance, she withdrew $280 at an off-campus ATM, nearly all of the money in her account. She then stopped at a nearby liquor store in Amherst before departing UMass. Quote, there is a receipt from a local liquor store in the Amherst area, and that's how we know she bought about $40 worth of alcohol on February 9th. After her departure around 4:30, she began to drive north. Quote, there's no activity on her cell phone past 4:37, Julie said. According to those phone records, that's when Maura called the New Hampshire condo owner. Her sister said the owner remembered the call, but did not rent her condo out to Maura. Between the time she left and crossed the New Hampshire border, Maura stopped to get gas. Quote, the car was pretty much full, so we know she got gas close to where the car was found, Julie said. Then at 7:27, a 911 call came in from a neighbor reporting an accident. At 7:42, a second came in from another neighbor, the bus driver. Quote, he actually stopped his bus right by the car and spoke to who we believe was Maura, Julie said. He asked Maura if she needed help, but Maura declined, saying she had called AAA. Quote, he knew that wasn't true because there's no cell phone service in the area. End quote, she said. He reported that the driver, Maura, was shaken up but appeared uninjured. Quote, within the span of those 7 to 10 minutes before the cops came at 7:46, she was just gone, Julie said. When the police arrived, the car was locked, the scene was searched, and Maura was nowhere in sight. Quote, we believe Maura was heading east, and the first officer on the scene never went east, Julie said. Quote, her book bag and some of the alcohol was gone, her cell phone, keys, and her wallet, Julie said. But why would she leave and walk on her own in the dead of winter? Where would Maura go? Quote, we know both airbags deployed, and we know the windows were cracked, and we know the front bumper was pushed in, Julie said. She could have had a concussion. It's cold, it's dark, and she's in an unfamiliar area, she added. Deep down, she believed her sister was picked up after the bus driver spoke with Maura. Quote, not a single piece of evidence has ever surfaced, Julie said. Not a single person, and no one has come forward. It had struck me that the world was full of holes. Holes which you could fall into, never to be seen again. I couldn't understand the difference between disappearance and death. Both seemed the same to me. Both left holes. Holes in your heart. Holes in your life. Several theories have arisen regarding Maura's disappearance that day. The first, that Maura walked away from her life to start another. It has been theorized that perhaps Mora was depressed and simply abandoned her vehicle after the accident to start a new life elsewhere, but she wandered off and died of exposure. The phone call that she received before she left was from her sister Kathleen. They spoke about Kathleen's issues with alcohol and her issues with her boyfriend. Though possible that Mora may have been so upset about the call, she might have wanted to just get away from her life, it seems unlikely, since no trace of her was ever found. Another theory is that either Mora had someone else in the car with her or was driving in tandem with someone who then drove the two off somewhere else. One of the neighbors who called 911 after Mora's accident also reported that she saw someone in the car smoking a cigarette, though later the neighbor admitted that it could just have been someone looking at a cell phone. Again, this theory is unlikely since no trace of Mora was ever found. Could Mora have driven to New Hampshire to commit suicide? Many have theorized that because Mora packed away some of her dorm items, she simply was heading out to a familiar place to kill herself. Still, unlikely due to the fact that no trace of a body has ever been found, and that she had submitted homework right before she left school. If someone wants to commit suicide, why would they hand in homework? And the last theory, Mora was picked up by a killer and was later murdered. Could it be that Mora stopped for gas and a predator followed her or came along at the scene to take advantage of the situation? Could someone have forced Mora into their car with the intent to do her harm? Could someone have happened along that didn't mean her any harm, but an accident occurred that later took her life? This seems the most likely scenario, but who? Who might have happened along that may have either taken Mora or hurt her?
Over 17 years since Mora Murray's disappearance, no clear suspects have ever been identified. The most notable person of interest is Claude Moulton, whose name became known to many followers of the case due to his brother, Larry Moulton. In late 2004, Larry Moulton gave to Fred Murray, Mora's father, a rusty jackknife with stains that were of a reddish-brown color. Larry let Fred know that this knife had belonged to his brother, and he believed Claude may have been connected to Mora's disappearance, and that the knife may have been used to kill Mora. Fred turned the knife over to police, who hesitantly accepted it. Since it came into their possession, police have not shared anything publicly regarding the knife. At the time of Mora's disappearance, Claude lived just 1 mile away from the site of the crash. Larry described his brother as having a history of violence and noted that his brother's live-in girlfriend began acting strangely around the time of Mora's disappearance. In October of 2006, the house nearby the crash site was searched after Claude and his girlfriend had moved out. Police cadaver dogs detected a scent of possible human remains in an upstairs closet of the house. Carpet samples were taken by the police, but again, nothing about the carpet has ever been revealed since. Larry Moulton later passed away in early 2007.
The disappearance of Mora Murray is, to me, a very disturbing case just because there's no trace. There's no evidence. It was heartbreaking to do research on it.
It was, for me, it was too much mystery. There was so much unknown unknowns.
Yes.
That it was hard to peel through and really make from what I feel like is a consistent theory or a theory that could be true enough to be believed. One thing I want to say, and I'll probably make a lot of enemies or maybe generate a lot of hate mail from this, is that this case is 17 years old. The internet has been around for far longer than that. And you can see on the internet 17 years of people just churning through this case, trying to find any avenue for what did happen. They're trying to find that out.
Right. Agreed. And some of the things that we don't touch on are family involvement in her disappearance, which there's never been any evidence of. Police conspiracy about it, which there's never been any evidence of. Mora's boyfriend at the time, Bill Roush, his involvement, there's never been any evidence that he has been involved. He has an alibi, and it's, he was in the army, so it's a pretty good one. So we're not going to discuss things here that there is no basis of fact around. What we're discussing are the distinct possibilities of what may have happened to Mora.
Backed up by what we know, what can be proven and stipulated.
Yes.
I think that is the opposite of a large portion of what I've seen in researching this case from, you know, the internet sleuthing, internet sleuthers online. Is it's almost become toxic in a sense. And an example of this is if one actor in this mystery has not said something to the detail that someone would want.
They assume that there's some sort of conspiracy or something going on.
Exactly.
When there isn't.
Rampant. And it's like,
right. I found that most infuriating in doing the research for this, that there was so much speculation about the family, about the police and things like that. For the family, it broke my heart that, I mean, here they're missing their daughter, and then the father is accused of being involved by an internet sleuth. I mean, you can't just go around accusing people of doing things without any type of fact or any type of evidence. There is zero evidence that the father was involved in any way, shape, or form in the disappearance of his daughter. And to speculate about that is just irresponsible.
And it's damaging to the real internet sleuths that try to do their due diligence and go on the facts that are stipulated and go from there. And if we build on theory upon theory upon theory and say, okay, that's the truth, I'm going to go on and try to make a case.
It's a house of cards.
Exactly. Exactly. And it doesn't help find Mora.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. So that being said, the theories that we do have that were possible, that she walked away from her life. Thoughts on that?
Mora, and I'll say this from the get-go, she had a lot of problems. And she had a lot of drama that was around her, circling around her at the time of her disappearance. And she had a very short history of making bad decisions.
Agreed. But I don't think any of that is enough to make someone want to just up and walk away from their life.
And if she has a history of making such bad decisions, do you think she can make such good decisions at how to hide herself if she's making a new life?
Yeah, agreed,
going forward?
Agreed. And again, I mean, that is, it's unlikely because no trace of her has ever been found anywhere. So the fact that she just walked away from her life and started a new one somewhere else is absurd in my book.
The ability to do that without some sort of expert knowledge.
Yeah, I don't know of any 21-year-old that would know how to do. I don't even know how to do that.
Right, right. So, I'm discounting that theory.
Agreed.
Wholesale.
So, the next theory was that she was not alone on her drive or was traveling in tandem with someone else.
I don't think so. I mean, because there are two accounts of Butch Atwood, the bus driver, mm-hmm. and then the neighbor.
Yes.
At the time of the crash, they did not see a second car.
Agreed.
And 17 years later, that person driving that second car wouldn't come forward.
And again, still no evidence of her whereabouts now. So what happened if there was a tandem? It doesn't make sense to me.
And why not get in that second car?
Right.
If you just crashed your car and go to a gas station.
Right, like, or go to a place where there's cell service and or a little bit further up the road.
Yep.
All right, do we think that she committed suicide?
No, I don't think she committed suicide.
I don't think so either. I mean, again, as I previously stated when I was talking about this theory earlier, I don't think people who decide that they're going to go off and commit suicide hand in their homework to be graded.
Or take out money.
Right, or take out money. Although, I mean, there was speculation that she was just taking out money for alcohol, but she only bought $40 worth of alcohol. So, I don't know. I feel like she was heading up there to maybe take a weekend or so away, and that was what she was initially doing when she did not hit that curve appropriately and hit the tree. And then things went downhill from there.
Right. There's a lot of speculation about her motives for wanting to do her getaway in New Hampshire. And I can't reasonably say what I think was her primary reason for doing so, but we just know that she wanted to get out of campus.
But the evidence is there, getting the alcohol, taking out a little bit of money or all of the money in her, most of the money in her account. Just seems to me that she just wanted to get away from for a few days, perhaps. And that is sheer speculation on my part. I have zero evidence that that is indeed what she was doing. It kind of seems reasonable that maybe she just wanted to take a weekend or something, at least from her researching places to stay in Vermont and things like that. I feel like that is kind of a semi-logical conclusion.
I think so. I think we can infer that she did not want to talk to her boyfriend for a while. She did not want to see her friends for a while. I think those are two inferences we can make from the last correspondence she had with her boyfriend.
Right.
And her friends.
Agreed.
Did she run away from the crash site into the woods? And
I don't think that she... they would have found some evidence of her body. I mean, they covered a good, 12 square miles, around the crash site, no footprints, no evidence of a backpack, clothing, anything was ever found. If she had died of exposure, somebody would have found her body. They brought cadaver dogs in there and did this huge search. They put helicopters up with that heat sensor thing. I think it's called FLIR, in it. And nothing ever showed up. There was no heat signature, no nothing. The cadaver dogs didn't find anything. So there would have been some sort of evidence as to something, hair, fibers, backpack, electronics, something.
Yeah, so something, and the next theory is
that she was abducted and killed,
or picked up by another car, near the crash site. And for me, I mean, that's kind of the one I want to go with. As far as
I agree, I mean, the dogs that did the searching first off when they were searching for her scent, not the cadaver dogs, actually. Was like 70 yards away from the sniffer dogs went 70 yards on the road and then lost her scent. The only way that it didn't go off into a house, it didn't go off into the woods. The only way that would have happened is if she was picked up in a car.
It's like she just disappeared, but exactly. That doesn't happen. So you get picked up by a car,
picked up by a vehicle. She had to have been picked up by somebody.
And this is really theorizing, but hopefully it's informed theorizing, is Butch Atwood, the bus driver, shows up on the site, and he's a big guy, 350 pounds, old, has a
at 7 o'clock at night, driving a bus. I'm not getting into a bus with that man. I'm just saying.
And the first thing he says to Maura Murray, who just got in an accident, and who was drinking,
right.
And she says, do you want me to call the police?
No.
So that immediately scares.
Right. Her. I mean, I agree. And I mean, she likely took a look at him. Not that he is not an attractive man, but old guy driving a school bus at 7:30 at night, I'm not getting anywhere near that guy.
And for my two cents, every bus driver I've ever known in my entire life, I've seen as like a quasi authority figure.
Right.
So if I'm Maura, I'm going to think he's an authority figure, or he's going to make authority figures aware of my predicament, like the police.
Right, and then I'm going to get a DUI or whatever.
Right.
Right.
So I'm not going to go with him.
Right.
And so I'm thinking, this is my second part of this, is when she's walking away from the site, she does get encountered by another vehicle, and the person in that vehicle is younger.
Right. And she's more likely to trust somebody that's her own age than she would be to trust someone who she either finds creepy or an authority figure.
And perhaps that person does not say, want me to take you to the police station or anything like that.
Right. So it's someone that's her own age, they're going to say, hey, it's awfully cold out. Or if they're shady, they're going to say something really creepy. Or perhaps not. But
it's going to be something that's going to get her in that vehicle.
Right. I agree. And I think, honestly, she walked away from that crash site likely with her cell phone, trying to find a place to get service to probably call her dad.
Yes.
And let her dad know what happened, as much as she felt that that would have been disappointing to her dad, because she had just gotten into an accident 3 or 4 days prior. I think that that ultimately was what she was doing. That's what I would do if I were in that predicament. The first thing I would do would pull up my cell phone. I don't have service. I got to get out of the car and go walk to where there is service.
Yes.
I don't know anyone in this area. I don't want to knock on some random person's door. I'm 20 years old, 21 years old. I've been drinking. If someone smells alcohol on my breath and I go to their house, they're going to call the police. So I'm going to walk to where there's cell service. When she was walking, she encountered someone or a couple of people in a vehicle who offered her help.
Yes.
And either took her somewhere, and then later on there was an accident and, she died or whatever, or it was someone who picked her up who had complete nefarious intentions.
Yeah. I mean, in my theory that where she gets picked up, I don't make any other assumptions about what could have happened. It could have been a nefarious individual with horrible intentions, or it could have been a person that dropped her off elsewhere and then
something else happened. Yeah, no, I agree. So, I mean, it's sheer speculation at this point as to what happened, but I do believe that she was walking towards where there was cell service and somebody picked her up.
Yes. And she did not make it to her.
And she did not make it to the lodger cabin destination that she ultimately had planned to go. Which is the sad fact of this case. And unfortunately, that is true enough to be believed in my book.
She could be anywhere in New Hampshire. And unfortunately, I think she...
She could be anywhere in New Hampshire or Vermont.
Or Vermont. And unfortunately, I think she is dead. That's sad.
I agree. That is a very sad fact. But I do have to say, if you have any information about this case whatsoever, no matter how small you think that piece of information might be, please email us at trueenoughnation@gmail.com, or please contact the New Hampshire Cold Case Unit at 603-223-3856.
This ends this episode of True Enough. This episode was produced, written, and edited by your co-hosts, Catherine Duvall and Brandon McCowan. Thanks go out to our sources, which are listed in our show notes. All music was provided by Anchor.fm. True Enough is created by us and distributed through Anchor. You can find us on Anchor at anchor.fm/true-enough. From there, you can message us, or you can now email us at trueenoughnation@gmail.com. So please send us your questions, thoughts, opinions, and hate mail about any of our episodes. Also, please subscribe to us in whichever podcast app you like so you don't miss our next episode, where we try to determine what is true enough to be believed.